Good evening, and welcome to the memoir keynote presentation of the 7th Annual Boston Book Festival. My name is Paul Makashima, and I'm the book editor of the Boston Globe. The Boston Book Festival is perhaps New England's premier literary event. It celebrates the power of words to stimulate, delight, and inspire us. At the same time, it promotes different cultures and creative ideas and enhances the vibrancy of our city and our region. The Globe is pleased to be a longtime sponsor as it dovetails with our mission to chronicle the life of our community. That sometimes entails challenging what needs to be challenged, but as in the case today, it also means celebrating what deserves to be celebrated. And now, I think it's time that we addressed the 8-foot bride in the room. I'm speaking, of course, about the inimitable Amanda Palmer, whose memoir, The Art of Asking, was just released last week in paperback. As her subtitle says, Amanda's book traces how she learned to stop worrying and let people help. But from her book, we also learned some things about Amanda. We learned that her career began in performance art when she took on the role of a human statue of an 8-foot bride exchanging flowers for donations. And before she hit the big time with her punk cabaret band Dresden Dolls, she worked as, and this is only a partial list, a waitress in a German beer garden, an actress in experimental films, a clothes check girl for illegal sex fetish loft parties, a sewing assistant for a bespoke leather handcuff maker, and a stripper. Through these experiences and more, she learned both professionally and in her own life how asking for help breaks down barriers and builds trust. This evening, we have the opportunity to share in a conversation between Amanda and her husband, the writer Neil Gaiman, about the art of asking, or whatever it is that they normally talk about. And from what I could see in the green room, it probably has something to do with childcare. So without having her even have to ask for it, let's offer a little love to Amanda Palmer and Neil Gaiman.
So, hello. I'm the one that gets to ask the questions, which is enormously fun for me. I am Neil Gaiman, and yeah, if we move a little bit that way, the people over there can sit. There's people over there looking faintly sad. Hang on, watch. If we, how does that work? Amanda, if you move, happy people over there, can you see her? Okay.
Hi.
Everybody see everybody? Hello.
Wait.
Yeah. So, I strangely enough, am actually also an author. Amanda wrote this, The Art of Asking, out in paperback last Tuesday. I wrote this, a book called Trigger Warning, out in paperback this Tuesday, although they have advanced copies here. Autographed. Just saying. And I started out long, long ago as a journalist. I started out doing interviews, and the amazing thing about being an interviewer is that you get the best interviews out of people if you ask them the stuff you actually want to know, which sounds incredibly obvious. But actually, you'd be amazed at how many journalists just have their lists of questions that they think they ought to ask, and they aren't the mad questions that they actually want to know. Where this book is concerned, I am terrified that I kind of know all the answers. Because I got to live with you while a lot of this was going on. And then I got to live with you while you were writing the book. And at the very end of the book, I even got to come in and hack and make it shorter.
It was the relationship's largest trust fall to date.
It really was. She gave me a 150,000-word manuscript and said, I have to lose 50,000 words here. And I basically, and essentially it was as if, I mean, as it is right now, it feels like it's two books. It's a memoir and it's a manifesto, a sort of wonderful who you are, how you got there, but also what you believe. The 150,000-word version was a who you are, what you believe, and how to make money on the internet.
Well, how to use the internet.
How to use the internet to communicate with people. So, do you miss that chunk? Have you forgiven me yet?
No, I don't miss it. I mean, it also, you know, the thing I kept telling myself, so it really is, I mean, it's true. I gave Neil this giant chunk of paper. I mean, he printed it out, and it was this thick, and we were on an insane deadline to get the book in if it was going to come out on the date that it was supposed to. So there was no time for me to sit for a couple of months and mull and trim and cut and, you know, try out various edits. It was just this mad dash to the finish, which I think you can kind of tell when you read it. The thing that I knew that Neil would be good at would be to just, you know, take it down to some kind of essential story where you really do see that the point of the book isn't, it's not supposed to be instructional. It really is supposed to be about the theme of asking. And when I go off on a 15-page tangent about Twitter and how incredible it is and this thing that happened because of Twitter and this thing and this thing and how to use it and why people don't really understand it, it feels like it got so off topic. And while all that stuff is really interesting and a lot of people ask me about it and probably would have found themselves, you know, enjoying it or using it, it was off topic. And I was so immersed in the writing of the book and it was all so fascinating and relevant to me that I knew that he would be a better editor. And I still think that somewhere in a drawer, there's a 50,000 word book called, like, How to Use the Fucking Internet by Amanda Palmer, which is, like, not the harrowing emotional story of my life and how asking took me from point A to point B to point Z, but sort of about the things that I've learned and the mistakes that I've learned using and tools of the internet. And maybe I'll put that book out someday in, like, 18 years.
So, we've talked about it being a memoir, and we've talked about it being a manifesto. What is the memoir about? If somebody out here has no idea who you are, they are in this room because their aunt gave them tickets.
You'll love Amanda Palmer. She's very quirky. She also plays the ukulele. I think you'll like it here.
So they are here, and they are going to, after, they're going to be so inspired, they're going to be picking up your book. What are they going to learn about you and who you are and how you became that person?
Well, the story of the book is there's two stories. I guess it makes sense to start with what, I mean, the overarching theme of the book is asking, right? I mean, that's the title, and that was the theme that I was trying to chase. But it started with, you know, with crowdfunding. And I felt like I had always wanted to use street performance as a metaphor or a starting point to explain to people why crowdfunding works and why the future of art and music don't have to be dominated by this capitalist idea that there's a thing and there's scarcity and you have to pay $10 for it and if not, you are stealing. Because this was the argument that I was having with a lot of people in the music industry for years. And the more and more I looked at it, I really saw that there were two ways of looking at the world. The street performer's way, which is, I'm going to do this thing for you. We're going to have some kind of connection, and hopefully you're going to give me a dollar. And I trust you. And if you walk away, I'm not going to like run after you for a dollar. I'm just going to hope that the next person who comes along gives me a dollar. And there's this kind of faith in the universe attitude. But also, it works, because street performance works, and I did it for many, many years, and I was like, oh, there's this kind of faith you can have in humanity. And when I was invited to do a TED Talk after I did a massive Kickstarter and confused the music industry because they didn't understand, you know, why something like that could work, I just looked back and I was like, all I need to do is tell the story of street performance and what I learned and connect the dots and sort of explain why, you know, creating a community and creating a connection and giving something to someone for free and saying, and if it's worth something to you, will you help me, actually really does work. You know, it's not as ones and zeros as people want it to be, but it does work. And then, you know, as I started writing my TED Talk, I realized all the other things, the other constellation of things in my life that related to that. You know, the weird world of stripping and how that works and that strange human connection and exchange of dollars and my marriage and the things that I learned about asking in my marriage and my best friend, Anthony, who taught me so many things that led me to be open to the ideas. And none of that shit was going to fit in a TED Talk that was 12 minutes long. The TED Talk wound up just being pretty much about fan bases and street performing, but when I sat down to write the book, I was like, it has to be personal, because it isn't just about business and it isn't just about money and it isn't, and you know, and crowdfunding and art are never just about business and money. It doesn't work that way. It's always about, you know, art really only works and people really only want to give you a dollar when you've made them feel something. But how do you explain that? And so the story of the book is, it's sort of, you know, there's the story of business and art and how I went from being an artist who wanted to do something to being able to make a living at it. That's one story. But then there's the story of my marriage, where I had to learn to ask and accept.
How did your husband feel about you putting him in the book?
He was really happy. I love my husband. He was actually more... Can I tell a story?
I don't know.
Okay. Backstage, 15 minutes ago, we just had a baby. Just so you know.
No, we had the baby like 5 weeks ago.
And we brought the baby with us tonight because I've not been very far away from him at any given point because I'm breastfeeding. And I was like, should we bring the baby up at the very end of our talk and be like, hey, look, here's our baby. And Neil was like, no. And so, and I was like, okay, yeah, that is maybe a little tasteless. Okay, so we won't do that. And Neil's like, no, we won't do that. And my parents are here as well, my wonderful parents, who are like doing childcare at the book festival, which is awesome. And we were just, my parents, and we're discussing like, what if this and what if that, and you know, take him outside and there's the stroller and we carry him around. And the subject of like, what if he gets really hungry and needs to eat? And Neil's like, well, of course you just bring him on stage and breastfeed him. And I was like, oh, this is kind of what happened with the book, because Neil surprises me. He'll jump over a certain hump of conservatism and land in a place that I wouldn't even go. And with the book, I tried to be really careful to like protect our marriage, protect our privacy, protect him, not reveal anything that would endanger us and that, you know, would piss him off. But Neil actually...
And I understand your husband being English is easily embarrassed.
But he also knows how to make a good book. And there was a point where Neil was reading through everything I had done and turned to me and said, "You should put our abortion in the book." And I was like, "You're saying that to me?" And he said, "Yeah, I think it needs to be in there." And that kind of surprised me. But I'm glad I put it in. But it also is like, I mean, if you're asking me if my husband was supportive of the book, you couldn't have been more supportive, because you didn't just support me, you pushed me, which is the best kind of support I think you could have given me. Oh, I'm going to cry. Right? But that being said, there were also parts of the book where I would write dialogue, and then we would have like 2-hour arguments about how that didn't go. And he was like, I never said that. That's not what I said, but that's not what I said. And I was like,
she would have these amazing arguments and win them. And I'd be there going, but I didn't say those things. That elegant and brilliant point that you have just scored, demolishing me. None of that. And actually, she was really good, because what you said was, okay, then write your own dialogue.
So, I did. I did that with Neil and with Anthony. I sent them their chunks, and I said, I tried to get your voice right, but if you want to just insert what you actually said, go for it. And they both did it. They both would send me back new drafts with their dialogue rewritten. And I used it. So
mostly it would sound more like us.
Yeah, I think it
You know, I haven't actually listened to the audiobook yet, because I understand that you do your impression of me.
Yeah. I'm pretty nice about it, though. I don't make fun of you. I just try to do a, like, middle-of-the-road Neil Gaiman English accent. The audiobook is pretty good. If you're an audiobook person, you should get it. I haven't listened to it either, but I did spend 12 hours recording it, so I think I get the pass. But I have heard it's really good, and there's the music that's referred to and kind of ties the story together is also in the audiobook. So if you're an audiobook person, go get it.
So Anthony got to rewrite his dialogue. One of the themes that runs through the book is your friendship with Anthony, what you learned from him, and what you learned how it changed your life when he was diagnosed with leukemia. What were the biggest things looking back? He's been gone now since the end of June. Looking back, what are the big things that you take from your relationship with him?
I think the biggest thing he taught me was compassion. And not just compassion in general, but compassion for myself. And also, you know, he put up with me for a long time, like into my 20s, thinking that he was perfect. You know, because I was a teenager and he was this cool guy next door and my mentor. And he really taught me the lesson of imperfection and how to love in the face of imperfection, you know, which is part of compassion, I think. And, you know, our friendship really grew. It grew from something that was much more of a mentor-student relationship. And then in my 20s and my 30s, we really just became good friends. And, you know, I remember being in my 20s and saying things to him like, I'll never be able to repay you for the friendship you've given me and all the things you've taught me and all the ways you've helped me. And it wasn't until I got into my 30s that I realized it was really a two-way street, and that my existence in his life had also sort of helped him. And I think the main thing he taught me is that love, you know, love embraces the imperfect. And that's the most difficult thing about love is, you know, I was in a string of relationships in my 20s where I would just, like, as soon as things got hard, I would just leave. And Anthony and his love for me was so steadfast. And for the people around him that he really loved, he was so good at that. And he was not perfect. He just was not a perfect guy. And he would be the first one to admit that. But watching him struggle with himself and his own admission of his imperfections and his honesty, I think that was his biggest lesson to me, probably.
So how did his illness teach you about the art of asking?
Oof. Well, if anyone knew Anthony, they would know that he was not... he liked to be in control. And I think he saw... We had that in common. You know, he loved having control over his environment. He liked having control over the schedule. His wife, Laura, who's here, used to say, he's on a train that's going in one direction and the train doesn't stop and you don't get off the train. And when you get sick, you're forced to get off the train. You're forced to ask for help because there are things that you just can't do. And watching him go through that process of submitting to needing others, and the dance that we all did, I mean, everyone around him did this dance where it's like, and anyone who's had illness in their life, and pretty much everyone has, doing that dance of what's okay to ask, and then where do things get out of control, and where does the guilt set in and start to demolish everything, it's crazy. I mean, it takes you into a whole new place when you're that vulnerable. And he dealt with that, with the cancer on and off for 4 years. And it was 4 years of, you know, testing everyone in his environment was sort of involved in this dance with him about what is he asking for, what should we offer, what's too much, what's not enough, you know. And you got sucked right into this because part of Anthony's illness was Neil and I staying in Boston so we could be near him, so I could be near him. And, you know, Neil just flew with it, came with me, stayed here with me, rented a house with me, abided. And, you know, we watched this ripple effect of this one thing sort of shaped our lives. But, you know, I found myself feeling tested, going like, oh my God, what if Anthony's sick for 8 years, 14 years? Do we never leave? Do we stay here and keep helping? And... you know, I think asking an illness or like this, because that's the first thing that always comes up, is that vulnerability when you're ill.
So is the art of asking about being vulnerable?
Yeah, it is. Because that's the thing that everyone's afraid of. I mean, in order to ask for anything from anyone, you're fundamentally making yourself vulnerable because they can turn around and say, no, I'm not going to help you. No, I'm not going to listen to your music. No, I'm not going to come to your side when you're ill. And for so many people, and this is what happened after the TED Talk and also what I've seen resonate with people through the book, in so many cases, it's just easier not to ask. It's just easier to suck it up and deal or be alone or try to handle the struggle yourself. Because for so many people, that rejection, the fear of that rejection is bigger than whatever the thing being asked for is. It's too scary. And I think that sort of applies to everybody in all realms of life. You know, it's in relationships, in business, in marriage, in parents and children, in everything. I mean, the thing about the art of asking that drove me crazy is that when I started writing the book, I was like, oh my God, this book is about everything. I could have just kept going and going and going and going and going. At a certain point, I'm glad I had to stop because there was a deadline.
So have you now given up music to become an author?
No. Thank you. I know. I think writing is something that that you enjoy very much.
I mean, the tone of voice. That was that little thing that you do, dear. You have to have your hobbies.
Writing this book made me really understand Neil better, actually, because writing a book, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what it would feel like. I didn't know what it would be like. It was really pretty boring. I'm used to running around, meeting people, being on stage, throwing shit together, writing songs really quickly, being in recording studios, constantly being social, being around people all the time. And editing a book and working on a book is lonely, steadfast work at a desk that's not loud and exciting. And while I'm really, really glad I did it, there were definitely points in the last 3 months of writing the book where I was like, I just want to die. Please don't let me do this again. I like the form of writing that I seem to really be drawn to and like is like short form blogging and articles where I can sit down and cram all of my thoughts and feelings into one thing, like a song or a poem or a blog post, and barely edit it and throw it out into the world and, watch it burn and then move on to the next thing. And a book is such a commitment. But it also made me understand the 1,000-yard stare that happens when you're holding 89 concepts in your head at one time and trying to figure out how to thread them together, and someone says, "Did you hear that? 5 o'clock?" And you go, "Uh-huh." And then 5 o'clock comes, and the person never appears. And so it gave me some higher degree of empathy to, when Neil vanishes into writing land and book land, because it's not like writing a small thing. When you're writing a big thing, you have so much more to hold that you don't want to leave the world of your book because it'll fall apart. And I really learned that writing this, and I was glad to have learned it because I think I understand him, you, a lot better.
So we have a special guest.
Do we?
We do. I like that. That's a do we. And we do. We have a special guest invited by my wife to appear on stage with us.
And is it creeping you guys out that we keep slipping in and out of the third person? Because it's creeping me out a little bit.
I'm working very hard at it and quite enjoying it, actually. So, Amanda, would you like to tell people who the special guest is?
The special guest is Maria Popova, who is the writer, researcher, amazing dot connector of a website called Brain Pickings. And she is here at our invitation to join us on stage. Where should we put her?
Yeah.
Okay. Maria and I have been friends for a long time. We sort of met through TED and through Twitter, and she writes the most extraordinary blog that's also supported by her readers directly, kind of like I'm doing with Patreon right now. And she has written the brand new postscript for the paperback of The Art of Asking. And she now has a burgeoning friendship with our child and wanted to come up to Boston, so we invited her, and here she is, and she's going to take it.
So there's this wonderful sidebar story in the book about Henry David Thoreau, local hero. And it is about how when he started writing Walden, he went off in the woods to live in this cabin that he built with his own two manly hands to live the deliberate, self-reliant life. But the part that didn't make it into Walden was that every Sunday morning, his mom and his sister would show up with a fresh batch of donuts for him, which he would gladly receive and take home to the cabin and proceed munching on and writing about the manly, self-reliant life in Walden. And what's so wonderful about this story is that in our black and white culture that's so dismissive of nuance and of duality, we might be tempted to say, well, that's a kind of hypocrisy that discredits Thoreau's creative legacy.
Poser.
Fraud police. But what you make clear is that actually it was a special kind of wisdom, this recognition that the art of receiving and the art of giving are compatriots in the kingdom of culture and they're essential to one another. And so it became this kind of art of not having to ask, of simply receiving without self-consciousness, without shame. And that became the lens for the piece that I wrote at the end of the book, which is called The Art of Not Having to Ask. And in it, I mentioned this notion called dana, which is a Pali word, and it comes from Buddhism. And it's often translated as the virtue of generosity, but it's really this larger thing, this kind of open-handedness that's in responsive dialogue with need. So the monks would give their teachings freely, and the lay people who benefit from them would give back by making sure the sustenance needs of the monks were met. So in a way, dana is the art of not having to ask. And so I reread the book this week, and I reread the piece and everything you write about, and I had the sudden realization of how much of our life context and of ourselves we bring to everything and how much it differs depending on where we are in our life stage. And I realized something that I didn't the first time I read it, which is that when you tell the story of how you guys fell in love, love is the ultimate dana. Love is the ultimate art of not having to ask, because love only works if it's freely given, and it's not transactional, and it can be demanded. And in fact, the more we ask for it, the less likely we are to receive it. And so you tell the story of how you met and how initially Neil was very expressive in his feelings and in his intentions, and you kind of backed off a little and wanted space and wanted to see how things went. And you did the very natural survival brain thing of making a list of all the reasons why it's a terrible idea to fall in love with Neil Gaiman, including you had the age difference and he was famous and he was a little bit awkward in English and he didn't dance. And you didn't want to become somebody's whole world. But most of all, you were both nursing a broken heart from a previous relationship and we're going about it in different ways. And yet somehow you started falling in love, as you put it, diagonally and at varying speeds. And then you write this, which at this point in time is my favorite passage in the book. You write, though I was nursing a broken heart from my last breakup and he was still recovering from his, along with the shadowy aftershocks of his divorce, we edged towards each other day by day like two cautious but wounded animals and started to poke experimentally at each other's hearts, opening up little doors one at a time. It was a slow, self-conscious work. We both knew how damaged we were. At least we could joke about it. And bit by bit, we started to fall in love. It wasn't a plummet to the bottom of the love well, which was the only way I'd experienced falling in love. Those relationships tended to slam into painful realities when the initial rush was over. This one was different. It was more like that moment in Wonderland when Alice's dress poofs out like a parachute and she floats down to the bottom of the well like a delicate feather. I love this, and I love it in part because in Alice in Wonderland, Alice never gets what she asks for. In fact, she almost always gets the very opposite. Mm. And over the course of the story, she learns to befriend these curiouser and curiouser, unexpected things, and to really master the art of not having to ask and of just receiving what comes and seeing what it becomes. And in a way, that's what falling in love is like. So I wonder, you guys now, having the hindsight of 2 years after having written the story and what 7 years after having lived it, what is it like to relate to this dance of asking, not having to ask, and trusting in that dynamic, especially when you have a small human to mediate all of it?
I don't know, 7 years on, I really like the fact that the small human basically either asks or doesn't ask. And he is very, very straightforward. He wants boob and diaper. It's like, that's it. Other than that, he will gurgle. As a relationship, I suppose for me, I definitely wasn't thinking about our relationship when we got into it and the 7 years since as a dance of asking or not asking. Mostly it was like this sort of strange transatlantic peace treaty as I would learn to speak American and she would learn to speak English. And when we were in Tennessee having the baby, and our very good friend Whitney came out and stayed with us, and she was Amanda's doula, but she also turned out to have this amazing skill because she had been on tour with me, and she'd been on tour with Amanda, and she spoke fluent Neil and fluent Amanda, and would actually translate for us. We'd be sitting at the dinner table, the three of us, and you could watch me and Amanda just sort of heading off into madness. And Whitney would say, okay, so what Amanda is saying is so on and so forth. And what Neil is saying is so on and so forth. And we'd go, well, then we're not arguing, are we? I think for me, it's always less about asking and not asking and more just about finding out what's going to happen next and learning to speak Amanda. Or failing.
I want to know what language the child's going to speak.
It'll be bilingual. It's what you wanted.
I think, you know, one of the lessons that Neil and I learn again and again in this relationship is, and like even backstage coming on for this event, we both always have an idea of how it's supposed to be. Neil and I are both, you know, calling us control freaks just is not very nice, but, you know, we talk about how we're always struggling for control of the narrative because we're both...
A phrase coined by our friend Danny, who one day turned around and said, the problem with you two is you both want control of the narrative. And so, and we're both, yeah.
But it's also how we've both learned to survive. You know, Neil's whole world is about being able to control the narrative and mine in my own way. But, you know, putting two people like that together and trying to figure out what world they're going to create is, you know, it's got its own kind of strife. The beautiful thing about the baby is, you know, we're both going to have to let go of his narrative, which is, I think, probably the best thing that you could do as a parent is not try to structure too much, and the largest leaps that we've taken in our relationship are really when either of us or both of us can just let go of the control panel and allow the other one to have their space or their way without scoring a point. You know, without saying like, okay, well, you can turn, but then I could turn. And this is...
I think that was really the lesson of this year, because things kept happening that we simply had no control over. Anthony's death being the biggest and the hardest, and the pregnancy and the baby and the ups and downs of that. You got Lyme disease at one point and were hospitalized. All of the stuff one actually couldn't control. So because one couldn't control it, one actually just simply had to allow whatever was going to happen.
And that's the beautiful thing about the chapter or the section that talks about you falling in love, because love only works if you stop trying to control it. And rereading the story this week, we were talking backstage, reminded me of this beautiful poem from the new Mary Oliver book, Felicity. And it's called Not Anyone Who Says. And it's kind of like a testimonial to your love story, but also to the universal love story in this Mary Oliver way. And it goes like this. Not anyone who says, I'm going to be careful and smart in matters of love, who says, I'm going to choose slowly, but only those lovers who didn't choose at all, but were, as it were, chosen by something invisible and powerful and uncontrollable and beautiful and possibly even unsuitable. Only those know what I'm talking about in this talking about love.
Mm. That's lovely.
So thank you for this beautiful book.
Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for guest starring.
Yeah, for coming and chatting.
Shall we turn it over?
So it's now we're going over to questions and answers.
There's a mic right here in the middle.
The mic is in the middle. The questions should get asked by people behind the mic. A brief reminder. The only thing I've ever actually said in my whole life that has been quoted by Tom Stoppard. So Tom Stoppard was when I was in Melbourne, and Tom Stoppard and I were both doing an event. He was there, and I began by saying, okay, questions. Remember, a question is a short interrogative sentence ending in a question mark capable of being answered from the stage. And the next day, Tom Stoppard got up in Sydney Opera House and said, as Neil Gaiman said, before the Q&A period. So, capable of being answered. What would you like to know?
Can I use a sentence, like a declarative sentence first, and then a second sentence?
You can do anything
you
want. You
have all the sentences you want.
I'm going to try to do it in two, and the second one will end in a question mark.
Just speak right into the mic so we can hear you.
Okay. So, Amanda, something I've been struck by in listening to your TED Talk and listening to you is how much people... I think when you talk about people being vulnerable and asking for help is a lot of them wanting to be connected to one another and how we live in a world in which I personally see a lot of loneliness and how much people want to connect with one another. And it's when they manage to and feel grounded in other people in a community that they find their happiest and best selves. And sometimes I wonder if we're like that with our environment as well. We're so inside and attached to screens that we're not out in fresh air and nature and the environment and experiencing our full selves in that way too. I was wondering, does that ever occur to you? Do you ever think in that way as well, or have you ever thought of it in that way?
Well, I think one of the themes that becomes obvious if you start looking at it is, asking connects us. The ease with which we can turn to our neighbors and our community, our loved ones, whatever, and ask for something kind of, I think, immediately reflects how healthy the environment is. Because the more disconnected we are, even if we're all right on top of each other, if we're living in a culture of fear, that cuts off all the asking because it's too dangerous to be vulnerable. And I think, we are so disconnected from each other. We're so afraid. And even with all the technology, I mean, this is the light and dark side of the internet, which I do get into in the book, which is it's wonderful to have all of these tools with which we can communicate and connect with each other. But if the tools are actually adding to the fear, which nowadays they really are, then we're not progressing. And it's really interesting watching what's happening with the internet, especially right now, because it's sort of the poison and the antidote. And the thing I love about something like Maria's website and the people who use social media to help each other and to drive the conversation forward and isn't just like a negative cesspot of like shittiness. If we're going to be, technologically progressing, there's going to have to be a lot more of that. And it's nice to see that conversation actually happening more and more nowadays. But yes, also being able to put down our phones and talk to each other is really important. And I mean, as someone with a new baby, I'm kind of thinking about that very deeply, because I don't want him just living in a screen and feeling connected to people through that medium. I want him to be able to ask in person. And one could argue that that's an art that's being lost, is the ability to look at someone and converse with them and ask, in the flesh.
Thank you. Next question.
Hey, if this has happened, Amanda, what do you do or what do you say if people in the book world make Neil Gaiman's wife the most important part of your identity when they talk about you in the third person?
The nice thing about our relationship is that we're both pretty proud of each other and pretty supportive of each other. And there are contexts, probably far fewer, than the reverse, but there are contexts in which he's Amanda Palmer's husband.
Such as?
Well, maybe not such as at a book festival, but but I mean, there are times where, you know, he kind of has to step back and I step forward, and then there's times when I step back and he steps forward. And I think, you know, the most important, and I've had to work through, I mean, I remember the first time in the first year of our relationship where we were in a room and everyone was really important and I felt invisible and I was like, I'm a fucking Amanda Palmer. I should, you know, like, that happens. But, you know, I've had to struggle, Neil aside, I've had to struggle with my deep desire to constantly assert myself, especially as a woman. And, you know, that can also poison things. And, you know, being able to stand by Neil's side in a lot of situations and stand back and feel fine with that has been its own journey. And that's much stronger than saying, you know, I need to leave the room if that's going to happen. That's just an ongoing part of any relationship, because there's always a power. You know, there's always an imbalance of power, but it's all context.
You get very used to it from the other direction as well. I mean, if I'm backstage at an Amanda Palmer gig, I'm her bloke. You know, I'm allowed to raid the, you know, the food. I'm allowed to eat the hummus, but basically, I am just sort of tolerated by everyone who actually has something real to do. Or, you know, if we're at the TED conference where Amanda Palmer at TED is considered this amazing TED star, and she has her husband with her. He's the one over there with the weird hair. But and it works both ways, and it's great fun. I am always incredibly proud to be Mr. Palmer. That's fun. Next.
As artists and celebrities, you've undoubtedly come across a lot of the cesspool that is sometimes the internet, and you clearly have people that love you, and I love you. You're both amazing, but there are detractors, critics out there. What's the worst criticism that you've ever received, and how did you? How did you deal with it? How did you grow from that?
I don't think I have a criticism that, like, takes the cake. Being called I think I quoted in the book, but, you know, the criticisms that hurt the most are the ones hurled by the people with the most power. And there was a New Yorker blog that came out around the time Theater is Evil came out, which is the album that I Kickstartered, and I think the quote was, Amanda Palmer is scraping every dollar off the hides of the desperate. And it was the name of the article was Amanda Palmer's Failed Experiment in Fake Communism. And oof. You know, when real journalists and, you know, real writers and stuff you know, poo-poo my ideas and criticize me. You know, the worst criticism you can hurl at me is to tell me that, not even that I'm inauthentic, but that my authenticity is all a ruse, and that behind it, there's sort of like this, I have some evil plan, and that I've just been practicing all my life to look like this authentic person so I can steal your wallet. You know, those are the things that hurt me the deepest.
And if I may add, because we have talked about this before, usually the stuff that burns the most is not the stuff that disagrees, but the stuff that misunderstands and misinterprets and tries to tell you who you are. So I think that's kind of a common denominator underneath those.
I've had it so easy compared to you. And I think a lot of it is just because I'm male, actually.
I'll take that.
It's true. Watching the crazy internet venom that when you have entered an internet shitstorm, the the venom and the madness are things where I go, look, I've had my own encounters with you know, mad people calling me things, and I once got personally attacked by a Republican senator in from Minnesota who called me a pencil-necked weasel thief. It was just amazing.
Not just a thing,
you know, on the mixed metaphor.
A weasel. No,
it was a weasel, and it was the pencil-necked weasel. And I like the pencil because that obviously indicated that I wrote for a living. But also that I probably wasn't going to be much, in a cage match he could take me. But you know, that kind of thing, just it happened and it died in seconds. And actually, that one, it was really silly because his mother made him apologize. But the stuff that you got was sort of, it goes mad for a while, and it's like, that woman! And they're not going, that person, it's definitely that woman!
You should tell the story of that amazing tweet you got from the angry feminist. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Oh, yes. I got the one of the first internet messes that Amanda trot into and then sort of had to try and wipe off her feet. She said some things that upset people, and I got a tweet from somebody, a feminist blog, basically telling me that I should actually be able to get my wife under control and get her to stop saying those things. And I'm looking at it and going, surely you see that there is people, please. Next
Thank
question.
Thank you for being authentic.
Thank you.
So you have a very large, dedicated fan base that you create art for. But you also have, your art is very personable, and in a way it's created for yourself. How do you balance creating art for yourself with creating art for a community?
That's a really good question. I made art for a vacuum, and art in a vacuum for a very long time. I started songwriting when I was, 10 or 11 years old, and didn't really share much very publicly until the Dresden Dolls, and at that point I was 25. But I always created with an audience in mind, and I think I knew that even when I was doing it, to the point where, I remember being 15 and actually visualizing an audience, because I didn't, I wrote a lot of really cathartic music, but to me the catharsis only worked if I got to watch you nodding going, I know, right? With the internet, one of the things that, when I look back at my songwriting and my productivity and where I put my energy, one of the things that the internet really shifted, and maybe not necessarily in a positive way, was I could write a song and perform it and get someone nodding their head at me, but I could also just write a blog and publish it, that moment, and have someone comment, understanding whatever metaphor I had just thrown at them. And this was back before you could instantly share music. And one of the things that I'm really interested in doing now that things have sort of come full circle, and you can use the internet to give someone a musical gift and not just a gift of text, is to get back to sharing immediately, but in musical form. Because, I was really lured away by tweeting and blogging, and because of I loved the instant gratification of it. But now that I have a Patreon, and I can just make a song and give it to you that night, it's really tempting to do that. But everything about the music industry has kind of taught me and sort of trained all of these musicians to wait and to market and to write some songs and record them, and 14 months later they'll come out, you know, when promo has been done and things have been set up. And I'm like, yeah, we don't need to do that anymore. Maybe we don't actually need to do that anymore. Maybe being able to give that gift immediately is going to be the way music works. And I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work, but I'm certainly excited about it because I watched my inner songwriter take a back seat to the one that was just excited to go like, look, I made a thing. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if that really answers your question, but that's sort of, that's what it made me think of.
All right. Thank you.
And I'm afraid this is going to be the last question.
This might be a little bit heavy, so if you aren't prepared to answer it on stage, let me know.
Oh, boy.
You had mentioned the death of your friend earlier this year, and I had a similar experience. I was wondering how that has affected you as an artist.
How it
has affected you as an artist?
Affected you as an artist.
How it's affected me as an artist. I mean, I think every time something significant happens to me, I feel like I owe it to myself and to the world to make better art in service of whatever giant things have happened. And that might sound really kind of vague and flaky, but, you know, watching someone die, and I've watched a lot of my friends die. You know, Anthony dying was a huge one, but, you know, both Neil and I have lost a lot of people just in the course of our relationship. And if anything, or if nothing else, every time something like that happens, I take stock of my own mortality. I look around at what I could do or what I couldn't do. And I always find myself thinking, why would I not go as deep as possible? If I'm looking at a choice and I could take the risk or not take the risk, why would I not take the risk? I'm going to die. And, you know, that might sound like kind of a cheap shot, but, you know, everyone in this room is going to be gone pretty quickly. And we will have either made something or not made something. And the artists that inspire me are the ones where I look at them and I'm like, oh my God, you didn't have to go there. It would have been safer not to, but for whatever reason, you did. And you know, every time a death happens, I'm just reminded that it's stupid to be safe. Because ultimately, you know, ultimately, usually whatever that is, wherever you don't want to go, whatever that risk is, whatever the unsafe place is, that really is the gift that you have to give. The safe spot is whatever you think is just going to be pleasing or whatever you think is just going to make people like you, that's not your gift. Your gift is that spot over there that no one else can see, and you're like, oh, do I really want to share that? Do I really want to say it? Do I really want to try it? And you do. So...
So we're coming to the end. Thank you so much. Amanda is going to be signing books afterwards. I'm going to be on baby duty, so I have pre-signed books.
Before we leave, do you guys want a quick song?
Oh, good Lord, a ukulele.
I'd like to just get a huge round of applause and a thank you to the Boston Book Festival for having us. And a huge thank you to Maria and Neil for being on stage with me. And a huge thank you to my parents for babysitting. I haven't played ukulele in a while.
In my mind, in a future 5 years from now, I'm 120 pounds, and I never get hungover, 'cause I will be the picture of discipline, never minding what state I'm in. And I will be someone I admire. And it's funny how I imagined that I would be that person now, but it does not seem to have happened. Maybe I've just forgotten how to see that I'm not exactly the person that I thought I'd be. And in my mind, in the far away here and now, I've become in control somehow, and I never lose my wallet, 'cause I will be the picture of discipline, never fucking up anything. And I'll be a good defensive driver,
which I find is particularly appropriate for the Boston audience. And it's funny how I imagined that I would be that person now, but it does not seem to have happened. Maybe I've just forgotten how to see that I'm not exactly the person that I thought I'd be.
And in my mind, when I'm old, I am beautiful, planting tulips and vegetables, which I will mindfully watch over. Not like me now, I'm so busy with everything that I don't look at anything. But I'm sure I'll look when I'm a mother. And it's funny how I imagined that I would be that person now, but that's not what I want. If that's what I wanted, then I'd be giving up somehow. How strange to see that I don't want to be the person that I want to be. And in my mind, I imagine so many things, things that aren't really happening. And when they put me in the ground, I'll start pounding the lid, saying I haven't finished yet. I still have a tattoo to get that says I'm living in the moment. And it's funny how I imagined that I would win this winless fight, but maybe it really isn't funny that I've been fighting all my life. But maybe I have to think it's funny if I want to live before I die. And maybe it's funniest of all to think I'll die before I actually see that I am exactly the person that I want to be.
Fuck yes.
I am exactly the person that I want to be.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you to the Boston Book Festival. And if you don't have the book, please buy it. If you do have the book and you loved it, please buy 6 or 7 copies to give to people you know. And I'll be signing outside. Thank you so much for coming.